From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pubani. On this episode, we're going to play you some of our favorite stuff from The Imposter so far. Tanya Tagaq has been called a punk Inuit throat singer, but it's impossible to really capture what she does. Her work is unparalleled, but she somehow manages to speak directly to the time we're living in. Here's our conversation.
I had to love Halifax a little bit, like the east coast of Canada. There's just this, like, you don't hurt a woman, you know? Like, you hurt a woman, you're going to get your ass kicked. It's it. Like, I really loved that when I first went down there, that kind of protection. Whereas, like, in Nunavut, violence against women is pretty rampant.
And people don't talk about it?
There's more and more now, like, that more and more now. And I always have to be really careful because I don't like the idea of, like, poverty porn or people getting off on the suffering.
Like that Of like the North movie?
Yeah, fuck that guy so hard. Like, we had a Skype conversation because obviously it was so upsetting.
And this is Of the North by, what's his name again?
I don't even want to say.
Okay.
It doesn't belong in my mouth. Yeah, I was just so grossed out by it, right? So I wanted healing to come and acknowledgement and learning to come with balance. Like, yeah, statistics are terrible, but it's also the best place in the world with the most amazing people I've ever met in my life. You know, so it's important to kind of acknowledge the shadow of the last couple hundred years has really been cast, and there's a reason people are living the way they're living. And it's not because of a lack of discipline. It's only because of oppression at the hands of the government. And only because of the ripple effect of residential schools, and only because of those things. Like, I think a lot of people don't kind of grasp that in order to have taken this entire continent based with slavery and genocide, that, of course, that undercurrent of thought still exists in the bellies of every citizen, brown or not. The reason I criticize the government so much is there's a purposeful lack of knowledge because they don't want to be held accountable, even monetarily. Because if the treaties had been respected, like, you'd be going to the reserve to get your awesome health care because it, you know? And a lot of people don't understand that. There's this ridiculous myth that it's out of laziness. But that shift in culture and the breaking of all those children, you know.
And it's pretty recent still.
I went to residential school.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, for high school. It was fine when I went. It wasn't a church run. And it was a little like jail. Like, I wasn't used to every minute being accounted for and, like, the times and all that stuff and the signing in and out. I wasn't used to that, but I had a perfectly fine time.
What school was it?
A K-12.
Okay.
And I was too wild of a kid. I couldn't have a roommate because I kept getting the roommates in trouble. So I had to live in the laundry room with the washers and dryers and a mattress. It was so funny.
Oh my God.
Oh, I laughed so hard thinking about, like, my dorky Doors posters and my perm living in the damn laundry room at a K-12 hall.
A bit convenient.
What a ridiculous. Oh, it's so funny.
So you were, like, wilder than everybody else.
People always have just said I'm weird. And I am.
So your new album is called Retribution.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was really interesting, especially given that so much of the word reconciliation is floating around settler Canada right now, after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so I was wondering, why retribution?
Because that reconciliation word's going too slow. I've had enough. I don't want to see people hurting anymore. I'm done. So people can throw around anything they want, but enough's enough. And people are going to have to fight back. Like if Stephen Harper had stayed in there, I think we'd be at the point of like full-on riot. And I think that Settler Canada really likes to think that they're very forward and in the know. But when you're living it, it's a different story. When it's your mom or your aunt, or when it's your people, when it's like your friends, your family going through this, like it's not like, oh, we have this great concept of reconciliation and, you know, there's 52 million bills that we have to change first and then we'll get to it and yeah, we're going to talk about it and it's going to be wonderful. And it's like, no, you're not living it. This isn't your life that you're losing. So hurry the fuck up. Like enough. Just enough of this shit. And it's just like when you've got people attempting to do seismic testing up in Nunavut where people are completely living off marine life, what do you think that's going to do to the whales? Do you think they're going to want to be around there? So less food, travel farther, more gas, more snowmobiles, like more money to go farther to feed your children where there's already poverty and hungry people. Just for your fucking development, you know, like there's ways that this can be done. And I don't trust the government to have our best interests in mind. Why would I? Look at the last couple hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you live in a country and in a world where you feel like your own citizens don't want you to be alive, your government wants you dead, people want you dead, racists want you dead, your fellow citizens want you dead. That's what it feels like. And then, you up in Nunavut, this is crazy. It's such a small population. Like, for example, seals, there's so many of them. We've been living alongside of them for thousands of years. And after the seal ban got implemented in the 70s, the suicide rate really jumped because people aren't able to provide. And it's a small population of human beings that aren't in full control of our land or the non-renewable natural resources. So when we turn to the renewable natural resources that we have, the only thing we have control of, and then you have these fucking idiots protesting it all over the world, these fucking seals, while they're running around killing literally millions and millions of animals every day in slaughterhouses. It's so angering. It hurts. It's like, okay, you turn one corner trying to survive and you're blocked, and then you turn another corner trying to survive and you're fucking blocked.
Yeah.
And the earth is not happy. It's climate change, it's happening. It's a fact. It's going on right now. And people are just like, la, 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 la. So it's kind of, that's what the album is about. It's like, look, this isn't going to keep functioning this way. There's going to be revolution. Earth is going to smack down on us. We're all fucking dead. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what the album's about. Like, get your shit together is kind of what the album's about. come on.
So, like many of us, Lauren Strapagale used to think that Guy Fieri was a huge tool. That was until about a week ago when she was in New York City and comedian Shane Torres took the stage and asked the audience a very important question.
What the fuck has Guy Fieri ever done to anyone? My name is Lauren Strapagale. I am a social news editor for BuzzFeed Canada, and I'm here to speak in defense of Guy Fieri. Everyone's all shitting on this guy for his weird catchphrases and bowling league outfits and love of lowbrow food, but who has he hurt? All he has done is be Guy Fieri without apologizing for it, and that pisses people off. You're not mad at Guy Fieri for wearing flaming shirts and his sunglasses on the back of his head like an idiot. You're mad at him for doing those things without any shame whatsoever. You're mad that he looks like a member of Smash Mouth, a band that peaked in 1999, but doesn't seem to care. You're mad that he can say, "We're riding the bus to Flavor Town," without hating himself. You wish you could live with so little shame. Look, I don't want to grab a beer with the guy. I think it's fucked up that he describes things as gangsta. But isn't it weird that we'd rather celebrate obvious jerks like Jamie Oliver than a guy who's just really big about putting cheese on stuff? Guy Fieri is a person that you are afraid to be. When you watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, you wish you're eating whatever disgusting, greasy shit he just called off the hook. Guy Fieri is just you when you're drunk. You go to the same local greasy spoons that he does. The difference is that you make little ironic sepia-toned Instagram posts out of it, but he gives them free advertising to a massive audience. So who's the real asshole?
Warrendale was a movie, but before it was a movie, it was a place, and it was a place where people lived, children, disturbed children, and caretakers. What I would like to do is to indicate how Warrendale, the place, was a much larger story than Warrendale, the movie.
In the 1960s, a couple named John and Debbie Brown opened up an experimental group home in Toronto. The name of the home was Warrendale. Many of the children were abandoned by their families or had behavioral problems. The Browns labeled all of them emotionally disturbed.
No! No! No!
The caretakers at Warrendale were young people in their 20s who were recruited from ads in the newspaper and paid 13 cents an hour. They lived with the children in a communal environment meant to mimic a family. In 1966, a young documentary filmmaker named Alan King was commissioned by the CBC to make a documentary about Warrendale. And despite the fact that they refused to air it, it became a classic and launched Alan King's career. The movie itself was groundbreaking for the time. There are no interviews, no narration, no host, no facts. It feels like you're watching real life unfold. You're not. When Alan King made this movie, he set off a chain of events that he could have never predicted. Like Alan King, the Browns were experimenting. It was the 60s. Freudian psychoanalysis was being applied to many different fields, and every aspect of life at Warrendale was being interpreted through that lens.
All of us were in this highly Freudian echo chamber It was very cult-like, if that's the word you want to use. So it was a lot of talk about mothers and fathers and anal and oral fixations.
That's Alvin Aylward. He was a caretaker at Warrendale. John and Debbie Brown were inventing techniques to try to help these kids. Techniques that now seem really strange. They would bottle feed grown children to simulate infancy. They would spy on them in the middle of the night and document their sleeping positions. When the kids acted out, they would physically restrain them using a technique they called holdings.
You're right here, close to me. Yes, you don't have to put your arms around me.
Why not? Why not?
Because I don't want her to!
Why not? Why don't you want her to, Carol?
John and Debbie Brown invited Alan King into Warrendale for his documentary. They had their own motivations for participating. Alan King gave them all his raw footage, which they used to make their own films promoting their Freudian techniques on the children. But besides the Browns, no one else had an understanding of what Alan King was up to. Here's the caretaker, Alvin, again.
He never explained what he was doing. That was above our heads. I don't remember signing a form. I don't remember ever giving any sort of consent. We were told that he was going to appear, and he was introduced. And from that point on, he was a part of our household.
Here's Tony, one of the Warrendale children. He's one of the main characters of the movie.
Like nobody knew or understood the grasp of what was going on. This is something that they just decided they were going to do. But they made it sound like they asked everybody. You know, but still, even when you ask, you're asking 11 or 12-year-old, what does 11 or 12-year-old know? You know, there were no documents drawn up. There were no, anything that was set in stone.
So there wasn't really any consent?
No. John and Debbie wanted to portray how well they were and how much of a nice program that they were running. But the fact is that it went right above their heads. They're forgetting the government's the money player that dictates. And that's when all hell broke loose after the film was done.
With Warrendale, Alan King wanted to make a new kind of documentary. He was breaking away from the interview-based format. His mission was to capture life as it happened with no direction whatsoever. He called this approach actuality drama. He was never present for any of the filming. He would retreat into the basement to let his crew film without interruption. Or so he thought.
You fuck up!
You don't
just
exactly what it is, Tony.
This is one of the most famous scenes in the movie. It's a caretaker performing a holding on Tony. She asks him, "What's bothering you?" And then he tells her to fuck off. In response, she pulls him onto the floor, screaming at him to tell her what's really going on.
I want to hear about the way Susan's holding her head. I want to hear about what's really bothering you, Tony. And I want to hear about why you're...
This scene made Tony the most recognizable face in the documentary. He's the poster boy. Literally, his face was on the poster promoting the movie. The holdings had always been a part of life at Warrendale, but according to Tony, the presence of the camera made everything more extreme.
She knew darn well what she was doing. She knew, but she was trying to push the limits. There was no excuse in the world for what she did. Why? It's because of the cameras. Strictly because of the cameras. Nothing other than the cameras.
In retrospect, everyone I spoke to seems to agree that they were all playing a part in Alan King's drama.
Tony, I think, played to the camera. Being a show-off, I think he may have overreacted for the camera. It was just a bit more, shall we say, dramatic.
Yeah, sure. I climbed up the top of the bloody cabinets and everything upstairs and the whole shot. Yeah. Because they were playing the bloody game. So we were playing the game, too.
I think he's right that all of us, if you want to use Alan King's term, were collaborating, that all of us were performing. If I sort of try to remember that little tiny two-month period compared with the rest of the time, but I do remember that there was a lot of violent holdings at that time.
When word got out about the movie, the violent holdings captured the public's attention. the CBC refused to broadcast the documentary, and the Ministry of Health didn't even know about the movie until after it was shot. They were just as shocked by it.
The film came out in 1967. It makes a big, big splash. Unfortunately, this board of directors got terrified. It's a very violent movie. It's a movie about violence, and it's a movie about adults provoking children to violence and then violently containing them, if that's the way you want to read it.
The board fired John and Debbie Brown, the couple who ran the home.
So the entire staff resigned, and there was this string of runaways. All the kids, 60 kids, were running away or were too severely disturbed to be running away.
The kids had no idea what was going on. Again, we were all in the air. What the heck's happening here? You know, it's like a bomb was dropped and all of a sudden, you know, things are happening and you have no idea what's going on. The people are leaving, this, that, and nobody's giving you any explanation.
Some of the runaways never returned. Tony ended up back at Warrendale, but it was under new leadership. The Warrendale Tony knew was never the same. He had lost his home. He did make new friends, like Mita, but things got a lot worse. Here's Mita.
When John Brown left and all hell broke loose, that was the end of something. When you take away their security and that, and it doesn't matter, you could be in an abusive home and you still have a sense of home and security because that's yours. And that's what Warrendale was. It didn't matter so much how the kids were treated or anything else like that. It was home. It was a place they felt safe and secure because it was something that they could always count on being the same.
At that age, what do you do? How do you comprehend that? How do you sort that out?
Tony comes back into Warrendale. He's trying to get back into living life. He's got new kids there like me and that. And then he falls out of a tree and breaks his back.
I felt like I was skydiving. I was like in a, you know, like a daydream. You know how sometimes you're not with reality, all of a sudden your mind is blank. Next thing you know, I open my eyes, and there she is up, and I'm down here. Nobody from that camp or whatever came or was there with me or anything. I mean, my life is a turmoil from a film. This accident is a result of the film being made.
Tony became a paraplegic. He holds the movie responsible for setting off a chain of events that led him up that tree. If the documentary was never made, maybe his old life at Warrendale would have stayed the same. Other people I spoke to agreed with Tony, including his friend Mita.
He lit a fuse. He lit a fuse. And the fuse that he lit blew up. But he didn't come back to see the pieces of what blew up.
Alan King isn't around to answer for this. He died in 2009. John and Debbie are dead too. But Tony is still living with the consequences of Warrendale, the place and the movie. Warrendale the movie was a huge success. It screened at Cannes. It's considered one of the most important documentaries ever. For what it's worth, it's one of my favorite documentaries. When it opened, Toronto residents flocked to theaters to see the scandalous documentary that the CBC refused to air. And Alvin went to the opening.
When the movie came out in 67, I remember going to the preview of it or to the first premiere and seeing important people who were congratulating themselves and congratulating Alan King. But I think I was the only staff there. There might have been two or three staff. The kids were certainly not allowed to go and see themselves. They all saw the movie and how they understood it, other than the fact that they appeared, you know. Oh, there's me, there's me. Oh, look at you, you look so funny doing that. I don't think there was any sense that they had of this great outside world and of the world that it was going into, and that they had no control over it.
As a conservative, I find the concept of change to be repugnant. And if we must have change, it should come very, very slowly. Rod Stewart is still the same. I like that. I like that he hasn't changed.
I'm Nicholas Godfrey. This is Internet Famous. So back in the mid-2000s, when I was a board student, I would, between assignments, go on Amazon and write fake reviews of products just to make myself laugh. Within about a year, I started noticing that I was getting lots of emails from people. And when I would Google myself, I found that there was numerous blogs that had written about me and that there was one mention in the New York Observer about this project. So after that, I started ramping up the efforts, doing more reviews, and became vaguely internet famous for a short period. So I write reviews under the name Mr. Quickly. I imagine Mr. Quickly as a kind of an idle man of leisure who sat around and ordered things off of Amazon to entertain himself and to fulfill whatever was missing in his bizarre personal life.
Cinnamon Toothpicks by Tasty Picks. 3 stars. Toothpicks really make me sentimental. I remember well my first toothpick. Gabriel. An admirable piece of wood.
I wasn't really that famous, but it seemed that for a certain, like, maybe very small population I was, and some of the emails I was getting were really strange, fawning emails about people who want to come and study under me and learn how to do creative writing, people who would email me and ask me when the next review would be. It was really bizarre because I didn't feel like I had any kind of fame at all. There's no monetary compensation at all. How could this be fame when, you know, I'm just still living in a rent-controlled apartment? People often mistook my reviews for real reviews, and that was the initial impetus for me to write them, is I liked the idea that you have a built-in audience already of people looking at a product, and then suddenly we'd be snagged by some bizarre commentary on someone's personal life in the middle of a review. And then Amazon introduced a feature where you could comment on reviews. And so you can often see people's misunderstandings about the reviews and how they'd get angry or freaked out by whatever the review was, or like really earnestly try and correct what I had written. And I think that was what initially made me want to write them, because I liked those kind of dissonances. When I started getting comments like, oh, you're so funny, this is the best review I've ever read, those fawning reviews made it less fun for me, because then I felt I was performing for an audience and it wasn't the audience I wanted. The audience I wanted was the people who were confused by the review and would have thought that this was a real person, you know, ordering codfish batter on the internet or writing a review of an ugly statue. That's why I initially wanted to do it, as a joke to myself.
Based upon the popular film Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat, a novel, is beginning to be recognized as a classic. Generally, the book is very faithful to the film. And what it lacks in the movie's luscious visual textures, it makes up for with Martin Del Rio's lyricism. In one episode of the book, Sub-Zero is looking at Scorpion, whose leg he has just frozen in a leg warmer of diamond butterflies. While Scorpion evacuates from the pigpen dungeon of his dirty guts a powerful authoritarian bellow. Such potency. This book is timeless. Immortal Kombat.
Every year or so, I'll just Google Mr. Quickly just to see what is being said about him on the internet or see if I have any new comments. And I noticed that New York Observer had called him the greatest wit of our age, which was surprising to me because, you know, it's almost 10 years since I stopped writing them. And then I noticed that People Magazine had a little online feature about funny Amazon reviews, and I was the first feature on there. To me, it was fairly disposable. I wasn't meaning them as any kind of lasting statement.
And Ladies of the Club by Helen Hooven Sandmeer. 3 stars. One particular highlight is page 168, where the author describes the relapse of a club foot back to its starting position, calling it a time-lapsed lilac closing in on itself. As the sun sets. Creaking. Beautiful.
The natural offshoot of the Mr. Quickly project would have been having actual voice actors recite passages that I'd written in a very earnest, very sincere tone, and the passages would be essentially what I would write under the Mr. Quickly name as excerpts from various fictitious novels. So I posted ads on Mandy asking for voiceover actors to narrate passages from what was a fictitious novel, although their understanding was that it was a real novel, a real job. And I got, you know, dozens of these clips in, and I have been sitting on them for a long time because I suddenly felt guilty about the fact that I was doing this without any kind of consent from the people sending them to me.
This is an excerpt from LeVar Chaventonson's debut novel, Tampico Coco. I threw the Phoenician trinket into the bulrushes and retched.
I tried to think of my home on the Falklands, but a wind whisked up a pant leg and chilled my testicles.
They seized up like a cold fist. Startled by the chilly frisson, I dropped my ream of cheesecloth onto the dead warthog.
The fabric was now ruined for tailoring, let alone cheesemaking. I stared at the dead beast's fresh stool. The blackened sludge tickled the air with a coating of thin silver worms, oddly more alive now than the warthog.
Johnson makes DIY filmmaking look easy, and he also makes it look good. Here's Matt. Yeah, I just wanted to hear you talk about what Operation Avalanche is about.
Normally I say it's a fake documentary about the CIA faking the moon landing set in the 1960s, but a lot of it takes place at NASA, and you would think a movie would fake the stuff that's happening at NASA, but because we didn't have any money and because we like shooting in this type of environment, we just went to NASA and shot for real. And all the people who appear in the movie, other than myself and Owen, are also all real. They're just behaving like themselves because they think they're in a real documentary.
So they were like employees of NASA?
The staff that we talked to at NASA, yes, are employees at NASA who worked there during the Apollo program. At its heart, it still is quite an authentic recreation of what those people's lives were like during the 1960s. And it really is celebrating them. Like, we're not making fun of those individuals at all. It's not like a Borat movie.
Mm-hmm.
What's really cool about sort of the fake documentary space where people believe that they're, it's almost like you and I talking right now, where it's like, imagine if I was secretly shooting this and my goal was to have a scene with somebody who was interviewing me and was very relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
You're not thinking about being an interviewer. You're just doing, like, you're an incredible actor right now, mm-hmm, at just being yourself. And it's something that all humans have an incredible talent for, unless you have some crippling social disability. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody can.
But even then, that's just your character.
Exactly. Exactly.
Everything that is alive is a great actor.
And unbelievably so, in a way that's so compelling when you see it in a fictional film setting,
yeah,
that you're so drawn to it because you never get to see that stuff. I think in our films, what's interesting is that Owen and I are easily the worst actors of everybody you see, because everybody else is just being themselves, and he and I are you know, trying to create characters, and we're being completely artificial.
Right. Do you think it's more important to just kind of work with non-actors, or?
Oh, I think it's completely different. I think working, as soon as somebody knows they're in a movie, they suck. I'd recently compared this to the Heisenberg principle, where you can't measure the speed and location of a particle, because just by looking at it, you add energy to it and it moves.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same way with behavior and human beings. You're incredible so long as you don't know that you're acting.
Right.
Are you going to ask me about the ethics of doing something like this?
No.
Oh, really? It's so funny. Normally when I have conversations about this, especially with, you know, like literate people,
yeah,
one of the big questions is...
Like people who can read.
I mean culturally literate. Okay. Is about the, like, the ethical question about doing things like this.
Yeah.
And my first movie as well, I mean, we shot illegally in high schools with real students who,
right,
had no idea what was going on. When people think you're crossing an ethical boundary, it's because in the back of their mind they think, well, you also must be crossing a legal one.
Right.
Which is to say that if you're shooting with somebody or you're shooting in a location without permission that you must be breaking the law or your film will be unreleasable. But it actually is not that way at all because of the way fair use works, which is, in America anyway, it's a legal concept that allows artists the fair use of media or footage so long as they're using it for a purpose that's transformative and critical to the story that they're telling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had to be careful with how we told the story and how things connected to the central story we were telling. An example is in the movie, like we go see Stanley Kubrick and we show the real Stanley Kubrick and we show his real sets and we use all this stuff that we could never get permission to use because the Kubrick estate is very protective mm-hmm. of Stanley Kubrick's image and basically everything from that period. They're extremely protective of it. But we were able to use it for free because it was so critical to the story we were telling. And so we get to do that cool sequence where you really see Stanley Kubrick's set for 2001.
So, but how would you actually go about getting this footage?
That's more trickier. You have to play a lot of games to get that footage. Okay. So being a student helps. Ah, man, yeah. That's where you can cross some legal lines that, because if you sign a contract with somebody and they send you some footage and you're like, okay, I'm going to send this to you, but you can't use it for this, this, and this, and you agree to that, then fair use won't help you because you have a pre-existing contract that says that you can't do that. So you have to find ways of getting footage from people that doesn't involve agreeing to pay them or to not use it. And that's actually not impossible because a lot of the times people who own huge banks of archival stock footage are willing to send you really shitty versions of right. that stuff. Because they know, oh, well, in a theatrical context, you'll never be able to use this. But modern visual effects has advanced to such a place where it almost doesn't matter what they do to the footage, whether they watermark it or make it really, really bad quality. We always found a way of using it, whether it meant like sending it to black and white 16 millimeter film and projecting it on camera or just scrubbing out all the watermarks. I mean, I probably shouldn't be talking about this, but there's a lot of like tricks that we used to get footage that normally you could just never have access to.
How much did the whole film cost?
About $1 million. We spent almost all the money on music and lawyers.
Okay.
Like the actually making the movie cost maybe $100,000.
Okay.
In a narcissistic way, these movies are kind of like blueprints for people to do the same thing. Like when I was a kid, I liked watching media that made me feel like I could do that. Like when I would watch something and be like, oh my God, I want to make a movie. It wasn't when I would watch like a Steven Spielberg movie because those are so formally inaccessible. It's like, yeah, I would like to maybe do that, but I have no idea how. Nobody's going to give me $100 million to do it. It's the very small, agile media where you watch it and you think, wait a minute, there's nothing happening there that I don't think I could do. And reality is, it's incredibly hard to make movies like this. It's not like some 13-year-old kid could watch Operation Avalanche and go out with his friends and do it the next day, but it certainly feels like you could, mm-hmm. and that's more important.
Right.
Like the fact that you feel like you could do it because it looks so stupid and easy, that is the feeling that we're trying to capture with young audiences specifically. I mean, not to say, I mean, sure, if some 80-year-old saw it and was like, I could do that, that's fine too. But really, it's about trying to recreate the feeling that I had when I was like 17 years old watching a movie and being like, wait a minute, this isn't so hard. And tricking those people because they will realize then, no, it's incredibly hard.
This episode of The Imposter featured Tanya Tagak, Lauren Strapagale, Nicholas Godfrey, and Matt Johnson. You heard the song Sex Machin, Sex Machine by Jeff Elise Barbara, When You're a Kid and You're Scared by Kite Hill, and Paradise by Daniel Caesar. This episode was produced by Kevin Sexton and Katie Jensen, with contributions from Andrew Moyer. Original music is by Nathan Burley. You can follow us on Twitter at Imster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can find me at Aaliyah Pabani. Our website is candlelandshow.com/imp, and our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/candleland. If The Imposter has ever introduced you to a new album you really love, or shown you a comic book, movie, or queer fantasy sports performance art piece that you weren't previously aware of, we're calling in a favor. introduce someone that you know to the imposter. We'll be back with a new episode of The Imposter next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.